It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right. We are back. Woohoo! You know, we started a new schedule here at Money for Lunch, and it's, it allows me a little bit of flexibility. My kids are out of school, want to take advantage of that because, that will change fairly soon. So they've had to go back to school in about a week. But we've had this new summer schedule, kind of enjoyed it, and looking to do more fun stuff. Also coming up, we have a marketing mastermind, marketing boot camp that we're going to be helping small businesses with. If you're interested, hit me up, give you the info on that. And then also, just FYI, for those who want to be part of my TV show coming up, hit me up on that as well, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. So we're going to be doing some stuff in Miami as well as Washington. So maybe you can come out and join us, support us, help us. And big thank you to Katy Perry, YouTube, and Ellen DeGeneres. Appreciate the support and the love on that. So, we're off to a great start. Looking forward to, seeing what happens, right? It's all about taking the next step no matter where you're at. Whether you're Donald Duck or Donald Trump, it's always about the next step. Speaking of the next step, my next guest, Margot Morrell, she is the co-author and the international bestseller of Shackleton's Way, A Leadership Lesson from the Great Antarctic Explorer, and author of Regan's Journey, Lessons from a Remarkable Career. Margot Morrell, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, Bert. Pleasure to be with you.
You know, I was not aware that you had done a leadership book on Shackleton's, because I think that, first of all, that's a great idea. I love Shackleton's story, the journey that this guy went through, and everything that him and his men went through was incredible.
Yep, absolutely. I came across the story in 1984 and was so intrigued I just kept pursuing it.
Yeah, and all right, so we'll have to have you come back and talk about that, because I just cannot wait to see what lessons of leadership you got out of that. So let's talk about Reagan's journey.
Reagan.
English is my second language, so bear with me.
Okay.
So tell us about your latest book. What was the inspiration?
The inspiration was that I had worked on the transition team in 1980. At the time, I was working for a executive search firm in Boston, and I'd been somewhat active on the campaign. And after the election, somebody called me and said, "Hey, the whole presidential personnel team is being run by Hydrogen Struggles alum. Here's the name, here's the phone number, call them and see if they want you to come down and help out." And the next thing I knew, I had a front row seat for the earliest days of the Reagan administration.
Yeah, that has to be a remarkable event. I remember meeting President Reagan. Man, I can't remember. It was a long time ago. Of all things, at an Amway convention, he was a speaker, and so was I. And it was kind of just a neat guy. And it's one of those things that you never forget. He had a lot of presence, so that must have been a remarkable time for you as well.
A tremendous experience, as you say. And, yeah, I got to see him twice in person, once on Inauguration Day in 1981. And, man, there's a photograph of him and Nancy in the car leaving the Capitol. And I just managed to, you know, one of those fluky moments in your life where you managed to be in the exact right place at the exact right time. I could have taken that photograph if I'd had a camera. And he just had a tremendous presence. And then the second time I saw him was during the 1984 campaign. And that time he came to Boston, and he did this rally on Boston City Hall Plaza, right under the nose, so to speak, of Tip O'Neill and Ted Kennedy. And that's what good shape he was in. He could do that. And again, it was just so interesting to see this kind of old warrior at that point walking up to the podium and just kind of shrugging his shoulders to – it was like a fighter going into the ring. It was fascinating.
Right, right. You know, he's also one of those voices that's been quite imitated. Well, Nancy, you know, I just forgot to duck or however. That was my best effort there. All right, so let's talk about this because, you know, thank you. You know, the deal with our presidents is that these guys are larger than life, and we don't get to really see our presidents. Sometimes we don't get to see them as humans, you know, or whatever, and all this other stuff. As you're putting the book together, did you learn anything about President Reagan that would surprise us?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, the funny thing about the book was originally the subtitle was going to be Leadership Lessons from the Great Communicator. But as I got into doing the research on it, that to me was not what was so interesting about him. In fact, the one truly outstanding leadership quality had, to my mind, was that he listened. And obviously you can't get much of a book out of that. He was an amazing listener. He would not say a word. He would have meetings with his cabinet in Sacramento and the White House, and he wouldn't say a word. He would just listen to what people had to say, and then he would go away and make his own decisions. So anyway, that was, I thought, super interesting. But as I got into his story, what really intrigued me was he is a poor kid from nowhere, and I mean absolutely nowhere, who decides at the age of 14 that he is going to go to college and he is going to make something of himself. And he sets about making it happen. And he graduates from college in 1932 at the dead bottom of the Depression. Unemployment is at 24% that summer, but he's got one thing going for him, which is a mentor. And one August evening, the mentor says to him, well, what do you think you'd like to do? And because this mentor is about to head back to Kansas City for the winter, Reagan is forced to hunker down and, as he puts it, think for a couple of days and a couple of sleepless nights. And he decides what he's interested in is, number one, entertaining people. Number two, politics, and in sports. And that's the beginning of his career. And within weeks, he has his first job as a sportscaster. And from that point on, he coaches himself to the top of five separate professions.
That's incredible. All right, so five separate professions. Let's go through them real quick. What are those five? Yep. So obviously, one of them is acting, and the other one's politics. What are the other?
Those are the two we always think about. Those are the two we all know about. And when, you know, asked a free associate on Reagan, we say, you know, movie star and politics. Well, in fact, in 1932, he figures, man, if I tell people I wanted to go to Broadway or Hollywood, it would have been the equivalent of saying I want to fly to the moon. But there's something closer, and that's a couple of hundred miles away in Chicago, and it's being a sports announcer. And that gives him the opportunity to combine his interest in entertaining people and his interest in sports. And he's gotten kind of he has practiced when he's a lifeguard and in his fraternity house, he's practiced calling games with ice cream cones and brooms. And that is his start, believe it or not. He goes up, he hitchhikes up to Chicago and knocks on doors, and there there's a young woman he runs into in Chicago at the NBC affiliate who gives him some excellent advice. And this is a classic Reagan thing, that he's always listening to the advice that people give give him, and he follows it to the letter. And she says to him, you're never going to get a job here. This is the big time. You've got to start in the sticks. So he gets home on a Friday afternoon and explains this to his parents over dinner, and his father says to him, well, can you, is there any place within like a one-day drive of Dixon? Well, there are a bunch of radio stations out in Davenport. Monday morning, he is in his father's third-hand car driving to Davenport, 75 miles away, and he is and he comes home with a job, which is not – it doesn't look like
wow.
much, but in fact, it is – it's calling four home games for the University of Iowa, which is a 50,000-seat stadium, and he basically is on his way in his and from – so – so 5 years into it, 1937, he decides he's out in Hollywood. He's made it happen. He's out there for Cubs training, spring training for the Cubs baseball team. And he basically gets the opportunity to interview with audition with Warner Brothers. And next thing you know, he has a contract with a major Hollywood studio. He's 26 at this point. And he actually gets his star. But he gets called up for service during World War II. So he decides to start giving speeches, and this leads to basically his extraordinarily successful career, this giving speeches. Then he gets involved with the Screen Actors Guild, and he becomes he is a labor. He is the head of a labor union. 7 times he is elected to the presidency of the Screen Actors Guild, which is a major, major fine organization. At the time, it had 6,000 members. I think today it's over 100,000 members. And then he, in 1951, he turns 40. His Hollywood career has flatlined. His bank account is empty. His fairy tale marriage to Jane Wyman is over, and he has no idea at that point that there is tremendous success ahead of him and an even better marriage. And what he is extremely reluctant to do, but what he eventually does, is go into television as the ambassador for General Electric on their television show. It's the premier show on television, Sunday nights at 9 o'clock, right after Ed Sullivan. And then at the age of 53, he is extremely reluctantly dragged into politics.
Now, when you say extremely reluctantly dragged, who dragged him in?
All sorts of people. From the early 1950s, Democrats started approaching him and asking him to run for Congress, for Senate. He'd been asked to run for governor, and he turned them down, saying at one point the hat didn't fit, or as he liked to joke,
right.
I'm a ham, always was, always will be. He had no interest, and it was a group of four people who had gotten to know in the 1950s around Los Angeles who come to him, and it's Holmes Tuttle, who owns a Ford dealership in L.A., and he keeps coming back and back and back and saying, please run this. And they eventually the speech that he gave for Barry Goldwater, and that is a huge hit. And after that, they come to Reagan and say, we want you to run for governor. And Reagan says, I'm not doing it by myself. And they set out to raise, through a fundraising effort, $10,000. They raise $100,000. He insists on. He says, I'm going to take some time to find out if people really want me to run. So he actually spends some time driving around California, talking to gas station attendants, talking to bellhops and hotel maids. And those are the people he listens to about, who are constantly saying to him, please run for office, Mr. Reagan. Isn't that amazing?
That's incredible. That is so cool. And I love that grassroots type of survey. You always have to survey your market to identify what they really want, and that's a great example of that. Let me ask you this. Here we are in a fairly historical presidential race now. Do you draw any parallels between, let's say, Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump?
Well, I don't know about you, but I can't say that I started out as a Trump fan. So it's been interesting to see how he has built this success. But the one thing that the parallel really with Reagan is that the country knows him. So he's already branded.
Yes.
And that's a fascinating, like, just like you said earlier, that you saw him at this speak at this Amway convention. If you ask a group of people if they ever saw Reagan in person, it's amazing how many people will have met him, will have. And I think, you know, the 21st century equivalent is the show The Apprentice. And so that people feel like they know Donald Trump. So his, whether it's the Republican primary candidates or the Democrats, he's already branded. People already know who he is, and they may like him, they may not like him, but they feel like they know who he is. And that
sure.
is basically the exact parallel with Reagan.
Yeah, and I think that is probably the only parallel that I would draw. I'm not necessarily a big Trump fan, but I think that you're right. I think you nailed it. They are both well-known, and that helps. Because we vote for people that we know, like, and trust, and I think that Trump had an added edge in this go-round. Let me ask you this. We talked earlier in the show about Shackleton. When you look at the leadership skills of Shackleton and then the leadership skills of Reagan, do you draw anything there?
Well, you mentioned earlier, you quoted Reagan earlier on the day he was assassinated with saying to his wife, "Honey, I forgot to duck." And I think that
right.
was a blast of, you know, pure Reagan without the media kind of getting in the way. When Lynn Nofziger, his longtime press spokesman who was filling in that day, actually, you know, when Reagan was shot, he insisted on walking into the hospital under on his own 2 feet. And because he wanted the people to see that he was okay. Of course, he was much
right.
worse, much worse shape than we knew at the time. And then he starts to make jokes, and he says to the doctors, "I hope you're all Republicans." And
that's right. I remember
Nancy,
that.
Yeah, I love that. That's
yeah,
my favorite.
Yeah.
And you know, and starting to. We just immediately got who he was, and basically after that, it was, you know, we all knew who Reagan was. We all totally got him. He led by example. He communicated effectively. He worked hard at keeping up morale, and no matter what, he maintained a positive attitude. And those are exactly what Shackleton did.
Yes, yes. And you know what? It's interesting because that's what we all need to do. I think there's some great lessons there. Margot Morrell, thank you so much for stopping by. I want to plug the book because it's a fun book, as you can tell us talking about it. It's Reagan's Journey, Lessons from a Remarkable Career. Reagan's Journey, Lessons from a Remarkable Career, available on Amazon or wherever good books are sold. Margot, I would love to bring you back, and let's talk about Shackleton next time.
Anytime, Bert. It'd be a pleasure.
All righty. Good stuff there from Margot Morrell, and just a fun, fun conversation. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
I'm calling the studio, Matthew.
You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Roderick.
Oh, yeah.
Roderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, you poor thing. You sound awful.
I resist.
Look, I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
With over 6 million auto accidents per year, insurance companies cut corners wherever possible. If you are being treated unfairly by any insurance company, call LibertyPropertyDamage.com right now. LibertyPropertyDamage.com will get you everything you deserve. Total loss, diminished value, rental reimbursement. Don't get pushed around. Don't get mad. Get LibertyPropertyDamage.com at 832-303-2378.
All right, we are back. And you know what? I'm getting already some feedback from, like I said, our last guest there, Margo Morrell and Reagan's Journey. It's really kind of a neat thing to talk about. And the other thing that's kind of cool when you're looking at somebody like this is that you can go through this and you can see that their life wasn't all, wasn't easy and or anything like that, that, you know, he's an individual just like we are, and so he struggled just like you and I do. I mean, struggle is part of the game. Life's not easy. That's part of the design. All right. So our next guest, Chris Clearman. Chris Clearman has a degree in industrial design from North Carolina State University and spent years working in the design field before starting his own business. Chris started his first company, Matador, while he was still working as a senior product designer at Silicon Valley startup GoPro. Chris has been able to combine the old-fashioned business ethics from his Southeastern upbringing with modern high-tech business tactics learned during his days at GoPro. Chris Clearman, welcome to Money for Lunch. All right, it looks like Chris's mic's kind of messed up a little bit. All right, Chris is going to try to call us back, and we're just going to wait a second here. Meanwhile, if he doesn't come back, then no big deal. We'll just catch him after our another guest who's here, Gary Schwartz. So, Gary, bear with us here. We're going to give Gary a millisecond or two to come back. And not, if not, you know, we'll just get we'll just keep going. The show must go on, as we all know. So that's really
I'm joining us, Gary Schwartz on the line.
Hey, Gary Schwartz, good to have you here. Let me properly welcome you to the show, telling everybody about Gary Schwartz. So, Gary, appreciate you calling in. While we and then Amy, our other guest, Chris, calls back, just let him know that we'll interview him shortly after we're done with Gary. Gary Schwartz is the author of a number of books on consumer behavior and mobile technology. He was selected as the Retail Innovator of the Year, as well as the Mobile Commerce Evangelist of the Year. Gary is a technology investor, as well as an entrepreneur, and speaks globally on how brands can best start up a relationship with their new consumer. Gary Schwartz, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
You bet. Now, okay, so let's talk about your book first. You wrote a book called Impulse Economy. Tell us why you wrote the book. What was the catalyst or the inspiration to write this book?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm a technology guy. I run a number of companies, and all those companies are focused on really, you know, this challenge that all businesses face, which is how to straddle the relationship between, you know, the old way we used to do business, which was just, you know, open up a store and say, hey, I'm here, you know, please come by, I've got something to sell you, and a new relationship, which is technology in the hands of the consumer. And so how do you start a new relationship with this very independent consumer who has the tools at their disposal to do a whole pile of things and isn't dependent on the store anymore? And so that new relationship that you have as a brand with that consumer is you know, befuddling to a lot of senior executives. And so I wrote a book initially called The Impulse Economy. I followed up with another book with Simon Schuster called Fast Shopper, Slow Store, which obviously dealt with the same quandary of that starting up a relationship with somebody who has more tools than you have internally. And I continue to write on that subject because it is something that all brands and retailers, anybody who's trying to forge a relationship and sell product needs to learn and command.
Gotcha, gotcha. All right. You know what, and what I think is so special about having you on the show is that not only are you a best-selling author, but you have all this startup experience, venture capital experience. You have a wide background that really, you know what you're talking from. It's not theory.
Right, right. Well, I mean, ultimately, it's a very exciting opportunity. You know, the problem that I just stated is a very exciting prompt to solve because there's a lot of, there's a lot of upside in solving that problem with various solutions. So, you know, if I'm not going to put my money where my mouth is, then I become this sort of abstract sort of, you know, evangelical consultant. I get excited about solutions that are solving that problem and I invest in them and I grow those companies.
Gotcha, gotcha. All right, so let's go back to impulse economy. You really dig into the behavioral side of consumers in this. You also talk about various ways that technology is affecting consumer behavior. Walk us through some of your findings in this behavioral change.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it comes down to what we all know, and the Leviathan in the space is somebody like Amazon. So Amazon's
right.
Sort of credo going into battle is, you know, one-click checkout, right? They actually have a patent on that, right? So when you go into Amazon,
they
take your billing credentials, and they have this thing where ultimately you can buy something by mistake, and I'm sure a lot of people in your audience have done that. It's so easy to make a purchase on Amazon once they have your credentials
that the
checkout is absolutely seamless, right? And the impulse economy is really all about that. You know, ultimately, it's doing something based on impulse. Because if I have time to think about a purchase, I, as a consumer, I'm busy. I'm going from place A to place B. I'm going to abandon the intent to buy. So the whole goal
right.
of somebody in the space is to capture somebody at intent. Don't wait until they're in your store. Don't wait until, you know, they're in front of your billboard. Capture intent when they have that, gee, I need a moment. And Amazon has, you know, is the blue-eyed boy in the space because has managed to build a business based on that one click. I think the impulse economy is all based on counting clicks to commerce and eliminating any click that isn't, you know, essential. And all apps,
right.
all checkouts are based on that one premise.
Yeah, you know, Amazon really good about that. I think, you know, they've changed their motto, their slogan various times. And I think the last change that they made is that the world's most customer-centric store
yep.
is kind of their new motto. And what I was going to say
was, so
it just so happens that we bought a couple of things from Amazon and we returned them. And as soon as our box got scanned at the UPS store that we were dropping them off at, I want to say the items got scanned. And before we left the store, I had an email confirming that, hey, thank you for returning your stuff. Your refund has been completed.
Right. Right. And look, in all fairness, Amazon is in order to do that, they have to lean on their suppliers, right? So it's not
sure.
Like, you know, Amazon isn't you know, ideal. They just good at what they do as far as, you know, the managing the funnel. A lot of that elegant solution that you see as a customer is pushed back down the supply chain, and there's a lot of pain. However, it is an elegant solution. I think what's really interesting about Amazon is they're introducing solutions right into the home. So they're not stopping at being a destination online. They've got Echo in your kitchen, which you can speak to. It's like basically an assistant like a Siri. And they're introducing something called the Dash, which is literally a button that you can put on the dishwasher, you can put on the coffee machine, that if you just reach out and push that button, it will reorder what you need, whether it be Tide, whether it be Illy's coffee, and it comes
nice.
To your door in many cities within 24 hours. So that whole idea of following the consumer and getting them when they need something and not waiting for them to open an app is that whole evolution of you know, aspirational evolution that everybody's trying to nail. And Amazon's just an example of one that does it well.
Yeah, no, they're the extreme example. Like you said, they're the blue eye boy of the industry right now, and we're at least a lot of us are trying to emulate them, and some people are trying to catch up to them. Let's talk about this, Gary, because you're also working on a book called If Things Could Speak, again, also being published by Simon & Schuster. Explain to me this new economy that you are writing about. You kind of mentioned this thing that the Amazon Dash, and maybe that's what you're talking about, but walk us through If Things Could Speak.
Sure. Well, I mean, If Things Could Speak is essentially leaving the internet, which, as you know, is relegated to a browser or, you know, an app store experience, and taking that interactivity that comes from obviously connecting to the web and putting it into an inanimate object. And we know, you know, the hero brands in that space are like the Nest thermostat and things that you put into your house that allow you
right.
to connect your phone to your home and make it, you know, a smart home, whatever that means. But what's happening is that If Things Could Speak is all about taking that interactivity and making it so that it isn't just relegated to one little thermostat or a fire, you know, a garage door, but it's actually taking it right through our lives and making inanimate objects like stores, like homes, like offices, like cities, it human. It's giving them a human face
right.
that not only can we interact with them, we can have a dialogue. And technology is getting to the point where we have very human-centered design, where objects aren't just things we reach out to and touch and click, but they're something that we can interact with and have a trust relationship with. And I think that as, you know, the relationship that we have through Siri, the relationship we have through Google now, is just indicative of the kind of relationship we will have to the proverbial toaster moving forward. And if people get that, if they get human-centric design, and if they can actually go beyond just designing cool things that appear, you know, in a TechCrunch article and that you would forward to your friends and say, how cool is this? But actually make it so
right.
that it's seamless and it's part of the way that's a huge revolution in the way that we interact with our environments.
You know, it is. It's fascinating. And I want to ask you this. Do you see that this is going to have a massive impact on traditional stores? I mean, is that going to be the, you know, the, what do you call it, the last nail in the coffin, so to speak, for traditional stores?
It's the onward going conversation of, you know, do we need to press flesh? You know, if everything's in the cloud,
right.
do we really need to walk into a store? And the answer is yes. because at the end of the day, we are human, and we need human interactivity. The mall is as much an entertainment complex as it is a shopping to facilitate shopping. And we need to congregate in places, and we need to try on things, and we need to talk to people, and there has to be some sense of, you know, interactivity beyond, you know, moving the mouse around. So stores will always be there, but they're going to change substantially. Amazon is coming back from the cloud into our physical world. They know they need a physical presence. They opened up a store in Seattle for books. I think that's the tip of the iceberg. You know, books are Amazon's gateway drug into commerce, and I think they'll start with books. But there are lots of examples of stores that are totally changing the way that they interact with people to hybridize the interactive experience and the physical experience. And so you're getting stores that don't, like, you walk in and they won't be based on the traditional, here's a pile of shirts, please find your size. They'll be based on what they call showrooming. So there'll be one shirt, and you'll scan it, and the app will know your size, and that shirt with that size will be in the change room waiting for you. And the change room and the whole experience on that side of the store will be beefed up. And it's proven that if you have that kind of relationship, if you're not spending your time looking for that particular size of shirt, but if you're just scanning a shirt and then finding it in the change room, and then they can throw in a belt and some jeans just for you to try on, they call it clienteling, that sales can go up by as much as 80% because you're focusing the attention and the interactivity on the right things as opposed to the frustrating things in the store. So stores will change because we're used to an optimized experience in the cloud.
Yeah, you know, I find that very interesting, and I think it's definitely the way things are moving. Look, right now, the biggest thing I've seen lately, both in male and female fashions, is the monthly box. You sign up for the auto ship, and they have your size, and they'll ship you out something every month that's kind of pre-selected, you know, whatever, and you spend a couple $100 and boom, you know, you get a shirt, trousers, belt, whatever it is. And I think especially for guys, we don't enjoy the shopping experience, or we don't see the shopping experience the way our female counterparts do. So I think for guys, this fashion in the box thing is very ideal. And also, back to what you're saying, as a guy, I'd love to scan something, go to the changing room, and then have not only what I picked out, but have some accessories as well that I didn't think
exactly
of. Because you know, at least for me, I'm very one dimensional. I always need help getting dressed or buying my clothes. Anyway, let's talk about this real quick since we're on this on this thread here. Starbucks, you know, is I think an interesting example for various reasons, but I want to get your thought on Starbucks, why they've been so effective.
Yeah, I mean, everybody, you know, we're talking about hero brands, right? So Amazon's a hero brand in the cloud. I think Starbucks is always pointed to as a hero brand in the physical world, right? I mean, they are the brand that continually is innovating with mobile technology, pre-ordering your drinks so they're there when you get there, obviously having a loyalty card and a mobile wallet, which allows you to seamlessly, you know, buy stuff, and you don't have to think of, you know, you don't have to flounder for change every time you need your caffeine fix. It is effective, and it is an amazing brand to look at. I would always caution people when you talk about Starbucks is that, you know, a brand is always going to be successful if it's selling essentially a drug on every corner in North America, right? So that helps. But what I find amazing about Starbucks is not only all the technology, but how they blend the technology with a huge insight, again, into just a relationship with their customer. And it's this blend of innovative technology and human insight, which are going to make brands and retailers and companies, you know, multinational companies, successful going into 2017. And it's little things like when you go into a Starbucks as opposed to another store, you get your name written on a cup. Now, if you order through your app, the name will still be written on that cup. And it's a luxury insight. You know, I mean, it's a very small thing, but I can tell you that that is a fundamental win for a brand that can immediately bond with a consumer. It's the one thing that makes most brands like a Tiffany or a Saks distinguishable from another brand that is more generic, is they clientele well. They know the person's name. They know their habits. They can, you know, they know what they like before that person has to open that their mouth. If a brand like Starbucks, which is not a luxury brand, it's luxury in the sense that it's not, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, but it can enable a relationship with their customer that uses technology but also uses that human side, that is why they're so successful. And I want the people to understand that it's not just about, you know, picking a winning technology horse. It's about understanding that technology only facilitates essentially what is the human piece, which is, you know, trust, and building loyalty and thrilling your customer, delighting them. And so if brands and retailers can keep that insight, which is, you know, hundreds of years old, that's just the good shopkeeper's credo. If they can do that with new technology, then they will be successful.
Yes. Well, you know what? And you hit the nail on the head. It's trust. Listen, the reason that most of us, literally millions of us, let Amazon keep our stuff on their website is because we trust them. The reason that we are going to buy from them, not only is it convenient, but we trust them. And so when I see people do this all the time, they want to compare themselves to a Starbucks or an Amazon or some other hero brand. And, you know, Starbucks is an overnight success that's been, you know, that was in the works for 10 years before they exploded on the planet, right? I mean, they were
exactly
slowly grinding it out like we all have to.
Mm-hmm.
And Starbucks has, you know, not only is it a luxury brand, but it's a brand of trust. I can go into Starbucks
exactly. And
you can have a very good experience, and I know that they're going to do whatever they can to make it good for me. And if you are an entrepreneur, you're just getting started out, or you've been in business for a few years, you may not be there yet where you have that crucial mass of people who know your brand. It just takes time.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, but it's interesting because there's another thing that goes with the trust, which is the in this day and age, it's very, very easy to lose the trust. And so you have a credible brand like Target and others that have been hacked into, that there's been data being the data has leaked out, and suddenly there's a question mark in the consumer's mind of whether that brand is credible moving into 2017. So as much as it takes a long time to build trust, it is also fairly easy to lose that trust. And so it's very important that any brand moving into a solution has to know that that solution is going to be solid, and they have to keep on honing their relationship with the customer to make sure that they don't go through these front page fiascos with various machinations. So
sure,
absolutely,
sure.
I think
now, hey, Gary,
pivotal in the digital age.
We're running a little short on time, but I want to.
Yep.
I'm going to have Amy reach out to you because we're doing something different. We're going to be putting together a video specifically for this segment that we're doing here with you. And when you get a chance, if you can send Amy some high res photos of yourself, your book, or anything else that you might be think it's relevant, we'll put it into this clip. Before you go, though, I do want to talk about this because this has become a sensation that nobody thought was going to be a sensation, and that is Pokemon Go. Not only did they come out with a game, but they quickly, came out with this game, and then they quickly, I don't know if you know this, I'm sure you do, but they now have a Pokemon Go dating app.
Yeah.
So,
I know.
And so the first month is free, and then after that, I think it's $20 or $30 a month, but I thought that was a smart idea because you see all these people – wandering around with their phone looking for a Pokemon, and I thought, well, you know, this dating thing is probably going to, you know, is going to really double their numbers. But what did you think about the whole Pokemon Go? You know, were you expecting it to explode like that? And you know, what do we learn from this?
Right. You know, I think you actually hit the nail on the head when you were talking about Starbucks being, you know, a hero brand that took 10 years to get there. I mean, Pokemon Go is a total retro phenomena, and it illustrative of a few points. One is, you need a brand that people can have a relationship with. AR and the whole idea of grabbing things from the air and collecting them is so old. I mean, as long as I've been in mobile, which I can't even, you know, it's been at least 20 years, people have been talking about AR and grabbing coupons from your phone. There's nothing new. The difference here is that there is now a relationship. Guys, the millennials who are catching these guys in the park and running into trees, played Pokemon Go as kids, right? And
well, you know, it's so funny because you talk about these hero brands. Look, I remember my son, who's 28 years old today, or not today, but 28-year-old. He's a 28-year-old now. Him and I played Pokemon together. That was one of the things that he was into. And so both my 28-year-old son and my 26-year-old nephew are out in the street. Pokemon, for lack of better
exactly.
terms. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're 16 or 17 or 28 or 30, they're out in the streets. This is a big brand.
It is, but it goes back to, I think, a lot of the points we've made in the short conversation, which is it's a trusted brand that's using technology the right way to build relationships with the community. Those relationships now, as you just indicated, are turning into dating relationships. If you can build a credible platform like an Uber, like a Pokemon Go, like an Amazon, you can build on it and create a Leviathan brand. And that's what I think Pokemon Go is showing us. Now, whether it, you know, goes beyond being a fad is up to, you know, the powers that be. But it is really, you know, you should look at that and then look at your business and say, what can we learn from it? Because there's a pile of things that you can take away from that.
Absolutely. Okay, so let me ask you this. As a mobile guy, as an investor, if the Pokemon people would have come to you and said, hey, we want you to invest in this, would you have immediately said yes, no? I mean,
yeah,
you know, what
are
your thoughts on this? I mean, obviously, 2020 is hindsight, but putting your investor hat back on, you know, take it back a few months before the game hit the scene, would this be something that you typically invest in, or is it too much of a hokey thing?
Yeah, I would have said it would be a huge fly. I mean, look, you go back to April 2014. Google came up with this, and you should Google this. They came out with an HR campaign, which was they were looking for the next Pokemon master. And if you look at that video on YouTube, so look for Google HR April 2014 Pokemon master or something like that. You will find the video. Okay. And I can tell you that video is exactly this game. It didn't take off after this. It was just a gimmicky little meme to get new engineers into Google. It took 2 years, and just it's one of those things where it just has to be the right time, just the right balance of the marketplace. Maybe it's a good summer and people are out and about. There is a magic to creating essentially a meme, which this is. You can never, ever put your money on something like this and take it to the bank. If you look at Angry Birds, again, you wouldn't have put your money into Angry Birds because it was one of 100,000 games that were being launched into the App Store. These are phenomena that hit and explode based on some sort of, you know, chemistry. And I can't I wouldn't put my money into chemistry. But there are solutions I would put my money into. And, you know, it's the luck of the draw in many cases when it comes to gaming.
Sure, sure. Well, you know what? And it's a luck of the draw even when you're looking at a sound business plan. So let's talk about this. What kind of business do you look at? What do you like to invest in?
Right. So I like to look at business models which are sort of, let's take social. So social is one of those things where you say, hey, you know, build a social app. So I started an incubator where the challenge was build a social app that doesn't rely on eyeballs as the business model. Those are the kind of things I like, because when you twist the business model that way, in the social apps, everybody will sell you a business plan that says, look, I'm going to capture 10 million eyeballs. They're going to be able to $2 an eyeball. Hey, look at what, you know, revenue I'm going to be getting year five. And all of those models fail in the same way that Pokemon Go fails. But if you challenge a business to say, look, what is a substantive business model that doesn't rely on, you know, a black swan, but it relies on good old business sensibilities. It's the kind of things we talked about in this interview. You know, how did, you know, a Starbucks grow their business? It wasn't an overnight success. How, you know, did, you know, Amazon sort of grow their business? It hasn't been an overnight success. But all of these companies had staying power. And I like businesses that innovate. I always go for IP. So I always ask my investors to look at patents, look at differentiation, even if it's just as a way of positioning yourself. But it challenges them. And it also helps them do due diligence in the market to make sure that they have something unique. And then it just comes down to picking the right team, right? Because it's all based on tenacity.
Yes.
All businesses get, you know, their door slammed in the face 1,000 times a day. If you have a tenacious founder and he can stand up and just, you know, continue, those are the businesses that will always win. And so those are the companies I like to fund. I like to fund people who don't, you know, need a big ramp, that they'll live on bread and water and they believe in the product. And I always like to find businesses that have an anchor, you know, like a company that's willing to give them 10 cents. Somebody who's willing to get money out of the gate is validation of product. So those are the areas that I like to those are the things I like to check off on the initial, you know, investment.
All right. So we have a question here from the audience. There's a husband and wife team. They have a patent. Speaking of patents, they have a patent on a hypoallergenic wetsuit. And this is not just a wetsuit. You can make wraps for, you know, like knee braces, elbow braces, you know, body parts. But they started off with doing a hypoallergenic wetsuit because people are allergic to the latex in a lot of these wraps, braces, and wetsuits. And so the deal is, the question they have for you is, would somebody buy just my patent, or do I need to go and grow the company first and then sell everything? Because they're not interested in keeping it long term, but it does serve a huge segment of the population.
Right. It's a good question. And so the recommendation I would give generically, and I don't want to speak too specifically about their particular product, but I always recommend that you build a prototype and you sell it to somebody, because nobody likes somebody who's, I'm not saying it's a patent troll, but it's essentially a paper sale. You want to put meat on the bone. So you always want to take your patent and execute a solution and validate it in the marketplace. So, and I don't know how hard that is to do with the wetsuit. It's not my domain. But I would always say to somebody, especially in technology, you know, to go out and execute on that patent, because otherwise paper will never give you the multiple that you require based on, I'm sure, all the hard work that they put into this. So that would be my first recommendation. The second one is, you know, obviously to go and sell it. So you need an anchor tenant. And remember, your anchor tenant could be the guy who buys it. So it's almost like a way of dating before you get married. So that would be, I guess, on the back of a napkin, what I would tell them.
Okay. I love it. Good stuff there. All right. So, you are an author yourself. Any books that you recommend for somebody, an entrepreneur, you know, one of your favorite books that you've read that you would recommend to other people?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a hard one. I like the Black Swan, Taleb's book. It explained that I think some of the things we were talking about before is that ultimately best plans can blow up because of black swans. And I think the whole phenomenon of black swans need to be understood in order to navigate it.
No, that's good. That's one. We'll say black swan. I think that's a great recommendation. And then last but not least, best advice you ever received.
Best advice I ever received. Maybe not the most profound quote, but, you know, I was always told to find a mentor. And I think that in life, it's always good. Some people call it gray hair. You know, you always need people in your team that have gone through similar stuff, because there is no way that you can grow based on, a finger to the wind. You have to have somebody who's gone through a particular experience. So I would always say to somebody, you know, as I've been told, find a mentor, find somebody who's smarter than you, who you can go to and bounce things off. So I would take that one to the bank.
I love it. I love it. I love it so much. Hey, you know what, Gary Schwartz, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today. We went through a lot of nuggets here. You gave a lot of information, that people can use, and I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing. It's been a blast.
Thank you. And if you could mention that, you know, a lot of the things I continue to write about and discuss, I post to ifthingscouldspeak.com. That's sort of my new site for my new book. So I have an ongoing sort of dialogue there on some of these issues.
Great. Ifthingscouldspeak.com. That's where we can stay current with Gary and all his musings. Gary Schwartz, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Good stuff there from Gary Schwartz. Just an incredible amount of data, a lot of useful information. A fantastic show. I want to thank Gary and Margo for stopping by. It's just been delightful. And as always, you know, we appreciate you guys here. We appreciate the fact that you give us your time, which is the most valuable thing you have. We appreciate that you help us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.